This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Once just a radio show, but podcast listeners like you are part of the fastest growing segment of our audience. So thanks for downloading what you might call the Pocket Takeaway. Here's our daily show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This hour, we're all going to be finding ourselves. That sounds like the Oprah show, huh? Finding ourselves on a map and elsewhere, quite literally. We will explore the fine points of geographic literacy. National Geographic is holding their annual geography contest. It's a spelling bee only with maps, and you better have a good map in your brain to win this competition. We're going to talk with someone who doesn't need to ask for directions in Mongolia or Kazakhstan or in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And you will meet a young man full of self-confidence as he faces college. You'd be confident, too, if you'd been accepted at all eight Ivy League schools and Stanford. It's part of our College Compass series this week, and he certainly seems to have a bright future charted for himself. But we begin in the middle of an aftershock in Nepal, nearly as big as the earthquake last month. Near the chaos near Mount Everest, it registered on the instruments of the U.S. Geological Survey in Golden, Colorado.
Every earthquake is still an earthquake in and of itself, which means this is, you know, by itself a very large, significant earthquake. However, because it's occurring as part of a series within the same general area of the rupture zone of the main event, we consider this also an aftershock in that series.
That's Amy Vaughn, a geophysicist with the USGS, monitoring seismic activity in Nepal. It was magnitude 7.3 on top of that 7.8 magnitude quake that killed more than 8,000 and made life precarious for millions more. How does all this complicate the already challenging geography near Mount Everest and the delivery of relief supplies in time to avoid the monsoons due in just a few weeks? We spoke yesterday with Jamie McGoldrick, United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator in Kathmandu, and then he was describing how the relief effort was becoming more orderly. The people were actually beginning to imagine getting back to normal. But today, he told us, all that has changed. Here's Jamie McGoldrick, just 50 miles from the epicenter in Kathmandu.
Well, it's pretty powerful in Kathmandu, so I would imagine 80 kilometers from here where the epicenter was, it must have been very heavy indeed.
And you felt it?
Very much so. We had to evacuate the office, and the whole of the office evacuated at the car park. We couldn't stand up at one point in the offices, and there was lots of swaying of buildings nearby as well.
You were describing some measure of stability coming to the relief effort. Has that been set back today?
Well, I think what it's done is, I mean, some of these areas have been hit hard by the previous earthquakes and aftershocks. And this has just basically compounded already difficult situation, one for the people who are living there in difficult circumstances and obviously for the relief effort, because we now have to spread out to a bigger area than was originally intended. And so it makes that work much difficult. And these areas are very challenging anyway, topographically, but also because of landslides and aftershocks and difficult road conditions.
And how are communications in the wake of this aftershock?
I mean, surprisingly, the mobile cell network stayed up and went down and came back on again. Our radio systems are working as well. So the communication is quite good at the moment, and hopefully it stays that way because it's very important.
They say the epicenter was near Mount Everest. What does that mean in terms of people who might be in that area?
Yeah, well, we hear serious stories of landslides in the Langkang region, which is the base where the base of the Everest is. And so in that area, you've got pockets of populations, small areas where people are populated. But the thing is, getting to them is going to be a challenge now because of these reported landslides on top of a very fragile environment and the monsoon rains coming as well. So it just complicates things that much more for us.
How much time before the monsoons begin? Any way to tell?
Yeah, well, normally they happen around mid-June, so like a four-week window from now. Some areas it comes in a bit earlier, but that's the planning date we're working to. And it's very important that we get as much assistance to those areas as possible. And that's why we have to get the resources, the funds from the international community to make this happen. If it doesn't happen in the next 4 weeks, a lot of the people who are in very distressing situations, it's going to be even more challenging for them to survive what sometimes can be a very difficult monsoon period, cold and wet in high mountain areas, cut off from other parts of the country. And after having suffered now two, three large earthquakes in those areas, it's quite an ask of people and communities to survive and get through.
And the geologists are saying you could get another aftershock at any time.
Well, and that's a science I don't really understand. I mean, they can't predict the earthquakes, but they can always tell you that more will come. It'd be great if they could give us better hard news so we could actually prepare for it. The one today was completely out of the blue. There'd been about 40 hours of very little, and all of a sudden we had this one, which was very, very heavy.
Jamie McGoldrick is United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator in Nepal. He's speaking to us from Kathmandu. Jamie, take care.
Thanks a lot.
The unpredictable geology in Nepal is more than matched by the unpredictable conditions in the waters of the Arctic, and that's where we turn our attention to. The Obama administration, in a controversial move, has granted approval for underwater drilling of gas and oil by Shell Oil Corporation. Shell has sought for years to drill in the Arctic's Chukchi Sea, considered to be one of the most dangerous places in the world to drill, with its icy waters, frequent storms, and low visibility. The closest Coast Guard station is more than 1,000 miles away, yet Shell is anxious to tap the major reserves of oil and gas believed to lie beneath the sea. Susan Murray is Deputy Vice President of the Pacific for the environmental advocacy organization Oceana, based in Washington, D.C., but we reach Susan in Juneau, Alaska.
We are skeptical about offshore drilling in the U.S. Arctic as it stands right now with the infrastructure that's available and the technology that exists, or actually more relevantly, doesn't exist for cleaning up oil in icy water.
And Shell has come at this a couple of times. In 2012, they tried to start a drilling project. Can you describe what happened then?
Yes. In 2012, Shell went to the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. They were permitted to drill top holes, which are shallow beginnings of wells. They were not allowed to drill into hydrocarbon-bearing zones because they did not have the proven safety equipment to do that. And throughout the course of the season, they learned how severe it can be to work in Alaskan waters, in Alaska weather. In the end of the drilling season, they had two vessels, the Discoverer and the Kulik, that were used for their drilling operations, both of which had to be dry towed to Asia. The Kulik was scrapped, and the Discoverer had a major overhaul to the boat because of damage that was done to it in Arctic waters. They simply were not prepared to operate up here.
Do you have any reason to believe that they are prepared now, 3 years later?
There has been no change that we have seen. The safety equipment that they are saying would protect us in the case of a major spill, they have tested in the calm waters of Puget Sound off of Washington. They have not tested it in Arctic conditions. And what we would hope that they would have learned by the 2012 season is that the Arctic is an entirely different scenario from other places where they may have tried offshore drilling.
But just to be clear, the position of your organization is there's probably nothing that Shell could do to reassure you to the point where you would support their drilling in the Arctic, correct?
At this point, there is nothing that Shell could do us to reassure us of that. As long as there is sea ice present, which there still is now, there is nothing that any company could do to mitigate that threat. In 2012, when Shell connected to the seafloor in the Chukchi Sea, within 24 hours, they had to move their drill rig, disconnect and move, because an ice sheet the size of Manhattan came floating in. And that's a force that no one can reckon with.
And what are you doing to combat this, or to at least get the message out that you're opposed to this?
Well, we have done a series of things over the years, including litigation and advocacy. And more recently, we've been looking into the financial side of this from the investment side. Is it a good investment on the part of Shell to keep putting money into the Arctic? They, by their own reports, have spent more than $6 billion on this endeavor right now, and they still haven't drilled, successfully completed one well. If you are an investor in Shell, there's reason to question whether that's a good use of the assets of the corporation.
And with oil prices around $50 a barrel, it's even more questionable of an investment.
That's correct. And not only that, with what we know from the Deepwater Horizon spill, there's now some tangible price tags put on what a disastrous spill could cost. And is the company prepared to pay that kind of cost? And have they let their shareholders know that that's the kind of risk that they could be incurring going to the Arctic? According to the Department of the Interior, in their own environmental impact statement, on lease sale 193, which would be the lease in the Chukchi Sea that Shell would be drilling on. Over the course of time of drilling, of exploration and production, there's a 75% chance of a major oil spill. That's a huge risk to be taking anywhere, but particularly in a place that has very limited infrastructure, is incredibly remote, and for 6 months of the year is in almost complete darkness and covered with sea ice.
Susan Murray, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Susan Murray, Deputy Vice President of the Pacific for the environmental advocacy organization Oceana.
I think the saying is, good, better, best. Let us never rest till our good is better and our better best.
I suppose there wasn't a lot of suspense for 18-year-old Victor Agafe after he opened the third acceptance envelope, or the fourth. I mean, if you got accepted at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Dartmouth, would there be much doubt about Penn, Brown, Columbia, and Cornell? Would you even care at that point? I mean, you know your test scores are good.
My test scores on the SAT, I got a 2120 on it. I took four subject tests. I got a 790 on U.S. history, a 720 on the chemistry one, 710 on math one, 710 on the biomolecular side.
So what could Stanford possibly find to quibble about in this application? But just in case...
I was actually just also named valedictorian of my high school class.
Pile it on, Victor. And he got accepted at all eight Ivy League schools and Stanford. He's attending Harvard in the fall. He's the son of proud Nigerian immigrants who put Victor on a success track a long time ago. And try as I might, there was nothing I could say to dampen Victor Agafe's enthusiasm about his future.
I'm excited, but to me, it really wasn't about me. It's more of a culmination of just the time and dedication my parents, my teachers, members of my community have just put into me throughout my years from like when I was just a baby to this day. And I really owe it all to them, you know, and I really want this to be more an inspiration for our generation, you know, and for kids my age to say like, hey, you know what, like we can make a difference. We can make a mark, because everything you see in the news today, it's always negative, you know. And I know we have a lot of social issues you're dealing with, but I think the more positivity we have out there and the more good things that are happening, I think the better it's going to be and the more we can all encourage each other.
How much is your story a way of really taking advantage of things that your parents didn't have? Tell me a little bit about growing up with your parents and what they expected and wanted for themselves and maybe wish to have for you.
The thing is, my parents, you know that here in America, it's just like the educational opportunities, the opportunities for social advancement, they're just unparalleled, right? So from the very beginning, they're always saying, you're the only person who can limit yourself, you know, both in the sacrifices they made to come here and to create a good life for me, and in the sacrifices many social advocates here in the U.S., you know, made 50 years ago. To them, you know, they've always told me there's no excuse for you not to do well. But at the same time, always remember, you know, where you come from, and always remember that it is important to give back to the community around you, because if it wasn't for other people, you would not have any of the opportunities you have today.
Give me a sense of the essay that helped to get you these acceptances.
I wrote about why I refuse to remain silent. And what it really was about is why in our school's diversity club, we decided to have a day of silence, right, in honor of the LGBTQ community. And I remember my acquaintances around school, you know, was very against the idea, right? And I remember, you know, for example, when he was like, I wouldn't even have like a college roommate who's gay. And to me, you know, I wrote my essay about why it was important for me to speak out in that instance and for us to lead that. And I connected it, for example, to like my experience as like an African-American individual and being judged, and for like how as a society, how we have to stand up for each other against any kind of prejudice in order to like achieve and gain the most from the great diversity we have around us.
Well, Victor, why don't you read the paragraph that begins with the words, I don't know what it feels like.
Absolutely. I don't know what it feels like to be gay, bisexual, or transgender, but I do know what it is like to have a facade of inferiority hang over me because I look scary. I know how worthless it is to pat the victim on the back or assure him in times of privacy that it doesn't matter what she thinks. This applies even in the most intimate of settings, as I find my friend is not the only one I must confront on such issues, but also my own personal heroes. But Granny, regardless of what the Bible says, isn't the struggle for gay rights just like the struggle for racial equality? I know that it may seem wrong to challenge those that have unconditionally loved and cared for you, but I must do so in order to ensure that all others can feel the same love from all people.
Did you ever say that to your grandmother?
Yes, absolutely. Whenever we were just discussing a lot of pertinent social issues, I'm a Catholic and very Catholic family. And, you know, she said, well, you know, doesn't the Bible say this? But I was like, but wait a second, you know, regardless, we all have to stand up for each other's rights, because to me, my Catholicism, my Christian religion, it's about loving and embracing all people, you know?
Are you the oldest son?
Yes, I am.
And in a Nigerian family, I mean, in a lot of families, in a Catholic family, I mean, that's a big deal. Oldest son, educated parents. I mean, you're college bound from the moment you take your first breath, buddy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I've been very blessed, you know, not only to like have the resources that I've had, but from the very beginning, you know, my parents have always pushed me to do the very best that I can do. And, you know, they held up a very high standard, you know, nothing less than A's. That was their rule. It didn't matter, you know. All the other outside things I love to do, student government, youth in government, the musicals, if I didn't keep my all A's, there's no way they would allow me to do that. So I would say they definitely set the bar for me really high. But the thing is, I think as you get older, it's not really about them pushing you at that point. It's like as you start getting towards like 7th, 8th grade, it's about like, hey, I want to do well because I want to open up opportunities for myself. And I want to make a difference in the world based on things that I'm very passionate about, you know?
But I think a lot of people will say you're under tremendous pressure to succeed. I mean, all of a sudden, boom.
I think of it more as like of an opportunity. With all the resources that from based on my visit that I saw that are available there, I feel like, okay, so to whom much is given, much is expected. So that's where pressure comes from in that instance. But if you just work hard and you sort of live with integrity, right? I'm still going to do my work. I'm going to read my textbooks, all that, because I want to be successful. You know, I think that's what makes the difference at the end of the day. And sure, I'm sure the classes there are going to get tough and I'm going to be with some of the smartest individuals in this entire world. But I feel like if you're willing to reach out to your teachers, just like in high school, for help whenever you have it, then I feel like you should even have a greater opportunity to succeed.
Victor, I have to say I'm sold. I'm sold. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much for your time, sir, and have a fantastic day.
Victor Agafe is a high school senior accepted to all 8 Ivy League schools and Stanford. Victor's story is part of a collaboration with PRI's Global Nation Project, which is exploring the benefits and the challenges facing immigrants in America's classrooms. To learn more, visit thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com, TIAA-CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry, and I do try to reply to as many tweets as I can. Thanks for choosing us to listen to. Our motto is share what you know, and there are plenty of ways of doing that. Check us out. Take part in the show. There's more at thetakeaway.org. How important is it to know your way around the map of the world? Chris Galechka, how important do you think geography is?
I think it's an incredible skill or field of knowledge for people to have. It's beyond just knowing, you know, where things are. It's your window. It's a way to understand, you know, the world, its people, and history, and things that affect all of us every day, from what we see on the news to, you know, what impacts, you know, how we go about our lives, how we earn our living.
And you earn your living by being the reference librarian at the Baylor University Law School, right?
Correct. I've been there for about 2 years now, and I really enjoy it. It plays to kind of what I like to do, which is answer people's questions. So I help professors with their research requests. I help any patrons that come in. I co-teach the intro to a legal research class there with the director and assistant director. And it's a great position. It's a great profession to be in. It's a great place to work.
How much would you say your success is related to the fact that you won the 1995 National Geographic Geography Bee?
Yeah, I guess it's hard to say that. I've kept it on my resume ever since I won it, and I keep telling myself, you know, once I finally get something more interesting on my resume, more recent, that I was going to drop it. But every single position I've applied to, and prior to coming here, I was an immigration attorney, and I was actually a high school social studies teacher. It always gets asked about. When I recall the interview I had at Baylor Law School, the one thing that the dean, who was part of the group that hired me, kept going back to what was that contest. So it's a fun little thing to include on it, and something I do enjoy talking about, sharing not just the win, but just my love of geography and learning and understanding the world.
Well, then don't ever take it off your resume, for heaven's sakes.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what did you win? What was the question that you won with?
So the winning question was, and it's probably a little less obscure now than it was in 1995, but it was Pashto and Dari are the official languages of what landlocked mountainous Central Asian nation?
That's Afghanistan, right?
Correct.
All right. So in 95, I bet that was pretty obscure.
It was obscure enough for me to win the contest, so I guess I'm fortunate in that regard.
Now, you know, the National Geographic Society has these polls that, you know, tell us all these heartbreaking statistics, like most young Americans can't pick the United States out on a map. What do you think about all that?
Man, I've heard these, you know, statistics all the time. Obviously, you'd like to see improvement in that, and, you know, hopefully with contests like the Bee or, you know, other opportunities for students to have fun with the topic, hopefully we can, you know, improve that statistic.
Is there a particular part of the world that you're more expert on than others?
I mean, I guess I have a general fascination. One thing I probably focus or I'm interested the most on is Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. My family background is from Poland. My dad was from Poland. My mom's parents were born there. And when I was an undergrad, I took 4 years of Russian on top of that. So I guess if there's an area that I'm particularly fascinated or interested in, that would be it.
So you knew where Donetsk was long before the current conflict in eastern Ukraine?
Yes, I did.
All right, well, I'm going to stump you with some Asia questions, all right?
Okay, go for it.
All right, so the capital of what country is Ulaanbaatar?
Mongolia.
Oh, man. The capital of Almaty, what country?
Well, Almaty was the capital of Kazakhstan, but several years ago they moved the capital to the city of Astana, which is in the north-central part of the region, and was previously known as Akmola, and previously to that known as Zelenograd in Soviet times.
Oh, you are just too much. All right, here's your bonus question here, as if you need one. Do Mongolia and Kazakhstan border?
They almost border.
Oh, get out. You are too good.
There's a very short border between China and Russia. It's the four corners that just barely isn't, because China and Russia share a very small border at that point and keep Kazakhstan and Mongolia separate.
That is fantastic, Chris. That is truly superior. And you can barely see that little four corners China, Russia border between Mongolia and Kazakhstan on Google Maps. You have to really sort of go in on it to see that indeed what you're saying is absolutely correct. Do you have any idea how many miles that little border is there?
Yeah, I don't have those figures memorized, but I can tell you the one thing that sticks on my mind about that is that some years ago, I'd say about 10, 12 years ago, National Geographic did a magazine article on some feature or some people that live in that Altai region of Russia, and it just had a close-up image of that spot, and that's what stuck in my head. And I would say I would gather maybe 30 miles.
30 miles, yeah, it's probably something like that. Well, Chris, it's fantastic. How many cities do you know in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan?
You know, it's funny. I've been to about 38 states yet. I've not been very to very many places in the in Michigan's own Upper Peninsula. I've been to Mackinac Island, St. Ignace, Sault Ste. Marie. I haven't been west of there. A good friend of mine is a city manager in the city of Lawrence, which is in the western part of the UP. I also have a friend who went to Michigan Tech in Houghton. There are plenty of other cities in the UP. You know, there's Newberry and Manistique and Ishpeming and Menominee and Ottonagon, Copper Harbor, Eagle River.
All right. You're piling on now. Christopher, I want to wish you the best of luck, and you certainly have a geographic knowledge that we all can aspire to.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you here today.
Christopher Galechka won the 1995 National Geographic Bee, then known as the National Geography Bee, which is now going on in Washington, D.C. He is now Baylor Law School's reference librarian. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you very much.
Who can compete with Chris there? But do you think you know your way around the globe? You can take the Takeaways Geography Quiz at thetakeaway.org. The importance of geography? Elizabeth, New Jersey. It matters like knowing your multiplication tables matters. You don't need the skills to navigate without Google Maps until you do. Grand Prairie, Texas. Knowing geography helps us understand cultural diversity. It's certainly relevant when it comes to understanding political agendas nationally and worldwide. Not learning geography would only serve to further enhance growing American ignorance. That said, Google Maps is the best.
Hi, this is Nikki Curry from Massapequa Park. Geography matters for credibility when discussing world events. But other than that, fortunately or not, I don't think it really does.
Hi, this is Arisa from Stillwater, Oklahoma. Yes, geography matters in the same way history matters. We're connected by stories that have been affected by geography. We can understand each other better, especially in a country full of people from such diverse backgrounds, if we have some clue about each other's stories.
Hi, this is Holly in Portland, Oregon. I think geography matters even more now. History, social networks, human work, environmental impacts are all accessible to all of us by knowing geography. Not everyone has the internet, and we still have places where Wi-Fi is not available. So I see geography as all about our Earth and therefore vital.
You can show off your geography skills. No cheating on Google Maps there. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our number. Much more at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
She has a voice that seems to be able to do anything in any style. She speaks with an unearthly energy, and she enters and leaves a room with a zephyr wind of mystery. But if there's one thing fans of singer-songwriter Melody Gardot know about her, it's how she invented herself as a performer after a near-fatal bicycle accident at the age of 19.
Well, I'm buckled up inside. Miracle that I'm alive. Do not think I can survive on bread and alone.
Gardot's pelvis was shattered. She had head and spinal injuries and was told she might never walk again. It was a dark place. Music not only rescued her from that place, but also propelled her to be an international vocal star.
L'espoir, from my farmer's arms to liberty.
Crooning about Portugal on her album The Absence. Not bad for a girl who grew up in Philly. Now onto her fourth album called Currency of Man. It's about what she has seen in her travels, especially in the United States. Years after her accident, she still speaks like someone who has cheated death and will have things her own way or not at all.
I'm not a trained singer. I know no borders or boundaries or techniques. I think my favorite singers are storytellers, people like Joni Mitchell, Johnny Cash, just because you can hear history in their voices. And I think when you're having the opportunity to get in front of a microphone and to express something, emotions, and depending how strong they are, can change the wavelength of your vocal so you can have a different color, a different tone, a different furious nature, or something more delicate too.
And if you like stories, you love the Brazilians. And you've been really successful in that style, vocally.
I think the writing heartbeat for me is most strong down in Brazil because it's all about poetry. The music is very poetic, and the songs are put to poetry, not the reverse. But now the record I'm doing is it's a step away from that. It's not the Brazilian music.
It's the hard poetry of America.
Yeah,
and
in a way.
And it struggles. And in some of those songs, I hear some Dolly Parton.
Really?
Even just the depth, the sort of intensity of that voice. And again, she's a storyteller.
My boobs are a little bigger.
Oh, now stop.
Just saying. No, I mean, yeah, she's great. She's really great. This album is something that I am very excited to be able to do live because we always do something different when we get to the stage. But it was the first time I sat down and wanted to put a book of things together that were speaking about what I was looking at, not just about what was happening to me, but what I was seeing. And I had gone away from the U.S. for a while because of work, because I'm touring and I'm writing. And I think I was a little bit shocked by what had changed. Being from Philly and also having visited L.A., my perspective on L.A. is a little bit less, but I did see so many changes from the neighborhoods I had been in, changes in the people and changes in the mindset. And I guess also because I had traveled so much, I can see in other cultures the way human beings relate to one another. And when I came to L.A., it felt a little bit cold and concrete and like we were forgetting our neighbors.
Well, there's lots of neighborliness in Philadelphia, but there's also a lot of divisions in Philly. There's a lot of the racial story in America in Philly.
Yeah, you have to run one block and walk two blocks. And when I was living there, my friends would get mugged on the way to my house. I'd watch people get killed by flybys, you know. Yeah, in the city that happens. And that happens because you have so many people so close together and you have different things that are going on, whether it's drug-related or race-related or robbery or theft and things, you know. When people are going through hard times, they tend to make bad decisions. So when you have a community of people who are struggling, you know, and people aren't finding a way to really get what they need, how can you condemn a hungry man for stealing a loaf of bread? I mean, these are normal things that tend to happen. But the record's not focusing only on those issues. It's just taking a look around at the world, not just the United States, but partially there, to see what's going on and how it's surprising to me and probably pretty surprising to other people, too.
With a very gospel and rock and roll sensibility in parts of this record.
Playing the electric guitar on record for the first time. That was so much fun. And it fit the attitude, you know, because I had this great old magnetone. And I have a Gibson Birdland that I love. I've had it for about 6 years. This was the first time I had the time and the encouragement and, like, the trust to sit down with, you know, a glass of tequila at 11 o'clock at night and just spend an hour and a half jamming like one of those kids in Guitar Center, you know, in front of an amplifier. And it was really kind of fun because I was really interested in the sound, like what kind of sound you can get from whether it's feedback or the tonality or kind of ripping a full tone over top the guitar to see what that does, what it makes you feel. Like when you have a lyric that's very strong and it's kind of aggressive, you might want to surround that by a sound that touches that. So it's not even note-based. It was just trying to get a texture, sonic texture that way. Preacher man, go tell me, where is body lie? Sit it down by the living of time, left him there to die.
Tell me about the song Preacher Man. What's the story? Why did you go there?
This song has an amazing story. And, well, I started from the beginning. I had been on tour with my band. And one day we were talking about all of what was going on with Trayvon. Because when we were on tour 2 years ago or so, he had been shot. So we started talking about the civil rights movement. And my drummer started to speak to me about this story of Emmett Till. And I'm so tired of seeing every good man gone. You can't help but feel the reality of that situation, and I think about it. And the point of the song, in the end, it has a very simple lyric. It's a recount of the history in a poetic way, so it's very hard to tell a life story in 3 minutes, you know, but it takes the poetry of what happened in that instant, and it puts it down on paper, so it's the perspective of his mother, his grandmother, and the feeling there. And I think of my mother, and I think of Emmett as kind of everyone's son, you know, because you can relate to that. Anybody who has children would know the feeling of, like, profound sadness to think that your child's going to leave the planet before you do. It doesn't seem to make sense, especially for a hate crime. But it got me thinking that maybe if people remembered that story, it would just put a kind of a consciousness out there that would open the window of the mind enough just to crack the door. So maybe you would think twice before you continue to behave the way you've been taught to be cruel to someone because of something like that and because of skin. So, bon, that's the thing. It's a little bit heavy, but the message in the chorus is, I believe in a world where we all belong, and I'm so tired of seeing every good man gone.
Melody Gardot, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Melody Gardot is a singer, songwriter, and musician. Her fourth album, Currency of Man, is out on June 2nd. And here's something to take with you today. This voice...
You've got mail.
Belongs to the ages. That was the notification from America Online, AOL, that you had email. AOL soon will belong to Verizon, though. Verizon is set to acquire AOL for $50 a share. Once upon a time, AOL, as an internet provider, was worth $182 billion. That's when Time Warner merged with it in 2000 in a disastrous move. Today, AOL is worth about $4.5 billion as an advertising technology company. The benefits of waiting. Verizon knows how to keep you on hold. That's all for today. If you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. Again, find us on iTunes or any other podcast service. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI. Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.